Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome back to Well That Aged Well. This week I'm joined by Philip Freeman and we're going to discuss the one and only Alexander the Great. And before we go into Alexander, I want to discuss and begin with the Macedonian society and discuss how, of course, and as well, I think if I remember correctly, the Greeks did not look too fondly. They were more or less barbarians in the eyes of the Greeks. And I want to, as well, when you discuss Alexander, I want to discuss how the view on the Macedonians after Alexander, if he changed the Greeks' view on the Macedonians as well. But let's begin with discussing the Macedonian society and what were the relations to the Greek peninsula.
Yes, thanks very much. The Greeks down in Athens and Corinth and Thebes and Sparta, they always looked at the Macedonians as barely Greeks, if Greeks at all. The Macedonians were way up to the north. They bordered all of the what they thought of as the barbarian people. And so they always looked down on the Macedonians. And the Macedonians had a very different sort of society. When you have Athens, you have democracy, and it's very what we think of as a very modern sort of government system. But the Macedonians were always kings, so it was very much like a Game of Thrones. I think is the sort of the best analogy I can think of to a modern television show. But it was a place that was very violent. Most of the Macedonians. Kings died by assassination. To use an American term, it was sort of the Wild West of the ancient world. That's what the Greeks would think of it, a place that was semi-barbarian at best.
So when Philip came to the throne, because like I said, most kings were assassinated, but what made Philip II, not to be confused with the King of Spain, but what made Philip II stay on the throne for so long? Because he seemed to be rather... Right. So I want to discuss Philip II, the reign as well before we get into Alexander, because he must have been quite a good king considering he wasn't... Well, we will discuss that later, but it seemed to be assassinated by some randoms in the Senate. So what did Philip do right that made him stay so long on the throne?
Yeah, Philip was an amazing king, and if he hadn't had a son who was even more famous, we probably would be doing the podcast on Philip because he was quite extraordinary. When he was a young man, Macedonia was a tiny little besieged kingdom that was barely anybody noticed. But Philip, he went to Thebes as a young man. He was actually a hostage in Thebes, and he learned about the Thebans, who were really good warriors, and he applied all of the lessons he learned. He built up a great Macedonian army. He built alliances. He was very good at diplomacy, and Philip is the one who turned Macedonia from an insignificant kingdom into the most powerful state in Greece, and who actually conquered the rest of Greece. Philip is the one who did that, and so by the time of Philip's death, Macedonia ruled all of Greece.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the eye scene with Philip, because it does his eye in a battle. I don't remember which one, but I think it's a bit just debated how he lost that eye, isn't there?
It is. It's a debate. Philip did lose one of his eyes in battle. Philip was not a general who sat in the background. Like his son Alexander, Philip was always on the front lines. And so there was a battle up in Macedonia, on the borders of Macedonia. And there are different accounts of what happened. Some say he was shot in the eye with an arrow. But that's you know, it's a very likely thing. We have descriptions of Philip. We have portrayals of Philip as wearing an eye patch, and so he was a one-eyed king, absolutely. And by the way, so was Hannibal, the Carthaginian general Hannibal. So it was not unusual in the ancient world.
So let's begin with his wife as well, because she will become, of course, as well, a vital part in Alexander. So how does he meet what will become his wife and later the mother of Alexander? Because I do think he has several heirs, if I remember correctly, but Alexander is the one, and Alexander wasn't necessarily the one who was supposed to be on the throne, if I remember correctly. It's a while
Yes.
since I thought my memory is a little hazy there, but you know, it's. I remember, if I remember this right, Alexander was not necessarily going to be the successor of Philip.
That's right. Philip actually had several wives. I think he had 8 or 9 different wives, and he did this to build alliances. And one of the wives he had was from a land called Epirus, which is modern-day Albania on the Adriatic coast, and that was Olympias. And she was a very young woman when they married, but she was brilliant and determined, absolutely determined, that her son Alexander, who was soon born after their marriage, would inherit the throne, because Philip had other sons, he had other children. There was a great deal of pressure from the rest of the Macedonian nobility to for Philip to name his heir from a Macedonian wife and not from a foreign wife like Olympias was. But in the end, and there were some ups and downs, and we don't know all the details, but Olympias prevailed, and her son Philip was named the heir of, I'm sorry, her son Alexander was named the heir of Philip.
Wasn't there a much younger wife than Philip as well in the picture that was almost teenager at some point as well, that could be a
Yes.
rival
Yes.
to the throne?
Absolutely. Not long before Philip died, he married a young woman of pure Macedonian blood. And so that was certainly, people thought that she would probably give birth to Philip's heir.
So let's begin with the upbringing, because I want to ask you about the movie, of course, later on at the end of the episode. But he does, like you said, he have a really close relationship with his mother. So, but let's talk about the upbringing of Alexander. Well, because later in life, I believe that Alexander would resent his father for every conquest he made. He was a conquest that Alexander couldn't conquer. I believe it's something in the line that the story goes, and that's why he would resent his father. But what was the relationship bringing Alexander up in the Macedonian court? And was there fair for his life with the siblings? Like we talked about, that he eventually would become the heir. But was there fair for his life with the competition to the throne?
Yes. Absolutely, there was competition. There were other possible heirs, and Macedonia being what it was, there was always a danger that Alexander would be murdered before he could ever become an adult. But Alexander, it was a certainly a very rough upbringing. Alexander would have been trained, first of all, as a warrior, and he was. He was trained as a very good warrior. He would have learned, and he would have watched, and he would have fought. Even as a teenager, he fought in the army. And so he learned the arts of war, but he also studied. He was a great student of literature, a great student of philosophy. And of course, he had the best teacher of all in the ancient world. He had Aristotle,
So
who...
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but how did Aristotle end up in the Macedonian court and would have this influence on
Yeah.
Alexander in later life? But they would fall out eventually. But how did he come to have such an influence on Alexander, and how did he come to the Macedonian court?
Well, it's interesting because Alexander's father was a physician, and he was the court physician in Macedonia. So Alexander grew up as a young man in the
In
court of Alexander.
Aristotle, I
I'm
believe.
sorry, yes, Aristotle, excuse me, grew up there. And so he was about the same age as Philip. And so he probably knew Philip. And so over the years, they maintained that relationship. And so when Alexander was a young man, then Philip, his father, invited Aristotle to come and be his tutor when Alexander was a teenager.
So what was the relationship? It seemed to be very close, but it was a close relationship between Aristotle and Alexander.
Yes, it was. They studied together for several years. Aristotle taught not just Alexander, but several of Alexander's friends, like Ptolemy, who would go on to found the great kingdom in Egypt. They were very close, and Alexander, from all accounts, was an excellent student. He loved science, he loved literature, and so they were very close. And that relationship would fade over time. But for a while, certainly Aristotle was probably the most important person in Alexander's life.
And we talked about the rivalry between. I want to bring him up again because I want to know if what were any of his siblings that would become a part of Alexander's army and part of his art would be close to anyone that would become a part of his entourage when he would create his empire that would become important to him later in life, or his siblings as well, whether.
The siblings actually probably weren't that important. Alexander did have an older brother, but he was mentally handicapped. And so he was always on the sidelines. He was always never expected to inherit the throne. The people who really were the ones who went on to become the great helpers, the lieutenants of Alexander, were his friends, people like Ptolemy, people from the Macedonian nobility. And so I suppose they were always a bit of a threat to Alexander, but Alexander attracted loyalty and friendship. And so he many of the generals in his army later on were people who were friends of his as a young man.
When does Alexander take his first command and lead the first army to his first battle, and when does it begin to kind of, when does where does the relationship with his father go astray? Because, like you
Yeah.
said, there is we will come to this very soon where he supposedly is accused of murdering his own father, which we will talk about in a second.
Yes.
When does it begin to take his command, and kind of where does the relationship with his father begin to restrain?
Sure. Well, Alexander leads his first command when he's about 16 years old. And so he had experience fighting on the front lines. He was from the very start, he showed himself to be a great warrior, and perhaps that was a bit of a threat to Philip, to people in the Macedonian court, because very soon after, Alexander and his mother were exiled back to Epirus, back to Albania, for a short time. But then Philip recalled them back to Macedonia, because Philip was planning his great invasion of Persia at this point, and he wanted Alexander to be a part of it. And so he invites Alexander and Olympias back to Macedonia, but I think the relationship between the father and son was always difficult, and I think at this point it was probably even more difficult because Philip was marrying the young Macedonian princess we talked about, and so Alexander had plenty of reasons to be angry at his father, and I think that certainly sets the scene for the assassination of Philip.
Let's talk about the assassination of Philip that brings Alexander to the throne. And there is, again, there's a debate whether Alexander was helped set up the assassination. And let's talk about the famous party in where Philip is murdered. So what is your take on the assassination of Philip? And do you think Alexander was involved? I mean, it's in the first time, I don't think it's unconventional to think that Alexander murdered him to get to power, but less what is your take on the famous death of Philip?
It's a difficult question. The assassination takes place in Macedonia. Philip invites everybody to this great party, this great celebration. The story goes that Philip was actually assassinated by one of his bodyguards, a former bodyguard. And what the people say is this bodyguard, his motivations were jealousy. He had been treated very badly by Philip. It's possible that Philip was simply murdered by a very angry ex-bodyguard, and maybe nobody else was involved at all. But conspiracy theories being what they are, and Macedonia being what it was, people began to immediately look at Alexander because he was the one who benefited. He had the motive, he had the opportunity. So it's really hard to know. I mean, personally, my opinion is, I honestly don't know who was behind the assassination of Philip. It could have been Alexander. It could have been Alexander's mother. It could have been the Athenians, for that matter. The Athenians were not at all happy with Philip. And so we honestly don't know. We know who actually took the knife and stabbed Philip. That was the bodyguard. But who was behind the bodyguard, we don't know, because the bodyguard was very quickly killed. And so that eliminated any possibility of testimony.
So let's talk a little bit about Athens, because with Philip's rise and his conquest in to make Macedonia this great kingdom, was there a threat that the Macedonians would invade Greece, the Greek peninsula as well? Were they worried that they would turn their heads and march towards Athens at some point?
Yeah, I mean, that was a great threat, because the Macedonians did take over Greece, and they did go down, and they fought a great battle there, and they subjected the Greek states to their authority. Alexander, well, very soon after he became king, went down and absolutely destroyed the city of Thebes as a lesson to the rest of Greece. And so there was always a great threat that the Macedonians were going to come down and destroy Athens. And so the Athenians, they were afraid. They did not like the Macedonians for the most part. But they knew the Macedonians were much more powerful than them. And so the Athenians actually were hoping that Philip and then Alexander would eventually lose, and perhaps the Persians would destroy them and get rid of their problem.
Let's talk about the Persians, because, of course, Alexander would very soon march towards Persia, and he would attack the Persians. And let's talk about his battle with Darius III and how the victory would later make him move towards what India and the rest of the and then begin his the creation of his well famous empire.
Yes, the Persian Empire is just an incredible study in its own right. It was enormous. It stretched from the borders of Greece all the way to India. It stretched up into what's now Central Asia. It included Egypt. It was as large physically, geographically, as large as the United States is. And it was ruled actually very well for an empire. The Persians knew how to do this, and they actually developed. They were the first ones to really develop a large empire and learned how to manage that sort of empire. And so they were very powerful. They had a very powerful army. And they were always watching their borders. And so they kept a careful eye on Greece and on Macedonia. Some people say maybe the Persians were behind the assassination of Philip. It's, again, hard to know, but they were an enormous, powerful empire just on the borders of Greece and Macedonia.
So I want to ask as well, you know, because Italy and Rome was still small and insignificant at this point in history, but were Alexander aware of the Italians or the Rome Latins, and was there, so why did he not turn the westwards and try to conquer Italy? Was it nothing there for him? Was there, but what could history have changed if he did so, or why did he not turn towards the Italian peninsula?
It's a good question. I mean, the Italian peninsula was much closer. It was divided into many different governments. It probably would have been easier for Alexander to conquer, but the Persians were the immediate threat. They had a history of warfare with Greece, and I think it was just they were occupying Greek territory, the territory where Greeks lived on what's now the coast of Turkey. And so I think that it was if Alexander. For one thing, if Alexander had turned to Italy, I think the Persians probably would have taken the opportunity and invaded Macedonia. And so I think Alexander felt that Persia was the immediate threat that he had to deal with.
Mm.
And, so, but he would eventually He did eventually say that he wanted to conquer Italy, but that was at the end when he was all done with everything else.
I was as well as talking a little bit about Sacro Sidon and talking a little bit about the Battle of Sidon and how was there ever how now before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about the Macedonian army as well, because it was quite a significant force to be reckoned with, as we have seen. It never really lost a battle as far as I'm aware. So how did the training of the Macedonian army, and how, before we go into the next conquest, I want to talk a little bit about this, how well the army functioned and the discipline, because it must have been severely disciplined in the Macedonian army. And how did the Macedonian army work, and what were they, what can you compare it to the Roman army, let's say, or how did training and everything, how long time did it train before going out on the campaign and the recruitment to the Macedonian army work?
The Macedonian army was actually very much like the Roman army. And I think the Romans learned a lot from looking at the Macedonians. The Macedonians trained endlessly. They worked very hard and they fought as a unit. That was the most important thing, is that they did not fight as individuals. It was not something like Braveheart or something like that. It was fighting as a machine, really. And so they knew how to turn, they knew how to advance, they knew how to retreat. They could move as a mass unit, and that is very difficult. And they were the heart of their army was a heavily armed infantry, foot soldiers, who had very long spears, longer spears than anybody else, which was great because they could use them against the enemy, but they also had to be much more coordinated because they could easily get in each other's way. But they also had a very good cavalry. Alexander was excellent on a horse, and they could move very fast. And so they had they also developed. They were one of the first armies to develop engineering, siege engines, all sorts of different mechanical means for fighting wars and for fighting battles. They were very good at that. And so the Macedonian army, both in their training and their equipment and their practice, really were they led the way for the Roman army, which would come afterwards.
Let's talk about it, because it begins, I believe he begins his campaign with Egypt, I think. So let's talk about his campaigns in Egypt as well, and how, and then of course we talked about the founding of Alexandria, which I think is one of his greatest legacies. So let's talk about, but let's first talk about the Egyptian campaign as well.
Well, what Alexander does is he invades the Persian Empire, and he lands very deliberately at the city of Troy. But Alexander was great about propaganda, and so he spends the first couple of years of his campaign. He invades what is now Turkey, and he works his way through Turkey down to Syria. There's a great battle at a river on the border of Syria and modern day Turkey, the Battle of Issus. He wins. He marches down into Lebanon and Palestine, and then into Egypt. And the Egyptians actually welcome Alexander because they never liked the Persians. And so they thought, well, we might as well welcome this young man, and he can be pharaoh, fine, as long as he gets rid of the Persians. And so Alexander marches into Egypt almost as a hero. He's welcomed. When he loves Egypt, he sees the pyramids, and that's when he goes to the coast, the Mediterranean coast, and he starts he founds he establishes a city which he names after himself. He was not modest, and that becomes the great city of Alexandria.
It's interesting that that's one of, actually one of the there are a few, of course, but this is one of few that hasn't changed name throughout its entire history of existence. It's still named Alexandria today, and it still shows the remarkable respect the city has, and it has its own biography that recently came out. And I think it was should have been the biography should have been better, but it shows the legacy of Alexandria, and throughout its entire history of existence, it has plays such a vital part in the history of the Mediterranean.
Absolutely. The city of Alexandria, after Alexander founds it, It quickly becomes the largest and most important city in the Mediterranean. It within 100 years or so, it has almost 1 million people. It becomes a great intellectual university sort of city. It becomes a great commercial city, tying together India and Europe, and it becomes incredibly important and remains so. And I was in Alexandria. I've been there several times. I was there just a few months ago, and they are still very, very proud of Alexander there. And you can see the remains of some of the ancient buildings, and it's actually a wonderful, vibrant city even today.
So Alexander actually never got to see the finished result of Alexandria, though, because he, of course, moves on and his dream is to conquer towards India. Is he aware of India's existence, or does he just want to go eastward and see how far he can come from and
Yeah.
go alone?
Well, he marches east. He marches across Persia itself, modern day Iran. He marches into Afghanistan, and then he marches down into what's modern day Pakistan and into India. He did know about India. He didn't know much about it. He knew that it was a very wealthy place. He knew that there was a lot of gold there, and he knew that it was the edge of the world. And so I think that was probably one of the factors that most drew him to India, is that it was the as far as he could possibly go. And when he got there and he won the battles against the Indian kings, he wanted to keep going. He wanted to go down the Ganges River all the way to modern day Bangladesh. But his army said, "No, we are not going any farther." And so they rebelled, and then eventually Alexander was forced to turn around and go back to Babylon, actually, which he established as his capital.
I want to talk a little bit more about the Indian campaign as well, but I want to talk as well about we mentioned Alexandria as just one of the many cities that he founded, but he founded many, many more that he wasn't very creative when it came to naming cities, was he? Because there's quite a few cities he named after himself as
Yes.
he go along on his campaign. But how many of these cities are though not, I don't think there are many other than Alexandria that still has his name, but how many cities today are still from the legacy of Alexander?
Well, he founds a number of cities in well, tw about 20, actually, about 20 Alexandrias. Even today, in Afghanistan, there's a city called Kandahar. And that ultimately comes from Alexandria Iskander Kandahar. And so it's a some of the cities are still there, but they really have lost touch with, I think, their Alexandrian roots. But he founds about 20 cities. They become very important, actually, in the centuries afterwards. They become centers of Greek culture. And so you could go to Afghanistan and see an ancient Greek play. You could go to India, and there would be Greek scholars there and Greek carvings. And they become centers, sort of colonies, I suppose, of Greek civilization throughout much of the ancient world.
Let's talk about some of the crew and generals of Alexander as well and in his entourage, because you mentioned Ptolemy that would, like you said, establish the famous Ptolemaic Empire, but not to be confused with the scholar Ptolemy, later scholar Ptolemy. But let's talk a little bit about the generals and the men behind Alexander as well that would follow him on his campaign. We mentioned in the
Yes.
earlier beginning that most of his friends from childhood would be probably important to Alexander later in life. So let's talk about some of the ones that
Sure.
stay with him all through his life.
Well, Alexander was only 19 years old when he began the invasion of the Persian Empire. And so he did have his friends like Ptolemy and some of the others, but he also had to rely on the older generation, Philip's generals. He didn't like this, but Alexander hated to rely on his father's generals, but he knew he had to. And so they were very important. And as he moved into the Persian Empire, and as the years went by, his younger cohort, his younger friends, took more and more power. And eventually the generals of Philip fade away, or sometimes they're killed by Alexander. And so you have the younger generation taking over from the older generation, which had fought with Philip back at the beginning.
So, were the competition among the closest the associate inner circle, if you will, that become closer to him and possibly become the heir or become his next second in command, were the competition among his closest?
Yes, there was always a competition among the different generals about none of them expected Alexander to die. He was only 32 years old when he died, and they thought he would probably live another 30 or 40 years. And so, but they wanted to position themselves, I think, from the very beginning, to be Alexander's right-hand man. And that didn't really happen, but there was certainly always a lot of competition among them. Eventually, of course, Alexander does die unexpectedly, and then that raises the problem of who is going to inherit his empire.
I want to talk a little bit, of course, more about that in detail a little bit later on as well, but I want to talk about this. You mentioned in the early episode his relationship with his mother, but as he goes on campaign, how is the relationship with his mother and how does it, because they seem, and in the movie they seem a bit too close for comfort, but how close were the real relationship with his mother and Alexander and as it grew older and as it went on campaign, did she go with him on campaign and how was she a good advisor for Alexander as they went on?
She was an advisor. Olympias was an advisor of Alexander, but she did not go on the campaign. She stayed in Macedonia and actually was very important, a very important figure in ruling the homeland of Macedonia, very influential. But she sent letters to her son frequently and gave him all sorts of advice and told him what to do. And she was not at all shy. And there's a very famous saying where Alexander is complaining to his friends after he receives these constant letters from his mother. He says, "My mother charges a very high rent for 9 months in her womb." And so it's a wonderful phrase. So she was always there advising. She would never actually see Alexander again after he left when he was 19. She would never see him alive again. She was a constant presence, certainly, to her son.
That's I want to talk about because you mentioned the that he had great interest in science and literature, and of course you said as well that he landed the supposedly on the location of Troy. And one of the things that Alexander really admired was the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer, and which he had in beside him every night. So what did he see in the Iliad and Odyssey that made him read it every night before he went to sleep
Yes.
and bring it with him constantly where he went? So what was it that he saw in this? Though of course the great as they are, what did you see in them? Was it kind of like a Sun Tzu art of war kind of thing for Alexander to do a comparison with anything?
In a way, yeah, it was kind of like the art of war, because the Iliad is a great it's a great story on many different levels, but it's also a great story about how to fight a war. But I think the main reason he brought the Iliad, the Odyssey with him, he slept with them under his pillow. He had a special edition made that Aristotle had put together. But he saw himself, Alexander saw himself, I think, as a mythological hero in many ways. He saw himself as a new Achilles. So Achilles is the great hero of the Iliad, and I think Alexander saw himself like that. I think he was very much a romantic, if you will, in that sense.
I want to talk a little. We mentioned that he would fall out eventually with Aristotle. So how, where, and how does he fall out with Aristotle as where the friendship deteriorates?
I mean, it seems to be gradual in a way. Aristotle goes back and founds a school in Athens, while Aristotle does not go with Alexander on the campaigns. But he has a couple of relatives who go with Alexander, including Aristotle's nephew. And Aristotle's nephew is actually killed by Alexander because he seems to be involved in some sort of revolt. And so I think that probably laid the groundwork for the tension between Aristotle Aristotle and Alexander, but they never actually, they never actually break. There's no big, public fight or anything like that. The story goes that Alexander would send biological samples from all of the lands that he conquered back to Aristotle, and whether or not that's true, we don't know. But there was certainly a distance between Aristotle and Alexander by the end of by the end of the campaign.
I want to go back to the Indian campaign as well before we turn to the death of Alexander, and I want to talk about because I believe the Indians used war elephant as well, which wasn't quite which the Macedonians of course weren't quite very familiar with. So what was the re how did the army react to war? And though of course as we have discussed before this podcast, I think war elephants weren't even reliable. As because they could easily just quite scared, but how were the mental? There must have been a mental impact as well on the Macedonian army to see the Indians use war elephants on as a form of t modern ancient tanks, if you will. And then again to do a comparison, but let's talk about the battle with the Indians and how the war elephants had an impact on the Macedonians, because it must have had an impact, right? On the Macedonians, when the something they never seen, like the Romans, when Hannibal came across the Alps with the elephants. So what was kind of again to do another comparison, was it kind of like when Hannibal came across the Alps?
I think it was elephants. The Indians did. Indians were the source of elephants. The Persians actually also had some elephants from India in their army, but it wasn't until Alexander and his army got to India where they really saw the war elephants used on a large scale. And elephants, actually, from what I've been able to study and understand, they were not that useful in a battle as far as tactics, but they are psychologically useful because they're these enormous beasts, and they're very hard to control. And so they will, even whoever has the elephants, they sometimes the elephants will turn on them. So it's hard to know, but they are very frightening. And the Macedonians were not at all used to elephants, and so I think it did have a certain psychological impact. Impact on the Macedonians, but they did not defeat them at all.
So I want to talk about the queen of Indian queen that would fight against Alexander. I'm just trying to get the name right. Cleophis, I think, if I'm not entirely mistaken. When she meet Alexander, she said, "Treat me like," and she said something in line. I might get the quote wrong, but "treat me like queen" or something in the line that line, I think. So let's talk about the meeting with the Indian queen and Alexander and how the meeting unfolds.
I mean, Alexander meets this Indian queen. He actually India was not a one kingdom, and so he meets several and defeats several different kings and queens in India. And the many of the women in Alexander's life. Alexander had a great respect for strong women, and so he meets this queen, and she, Alexander has tremendous respect for her. He never. We have no record of him ever abusing women captives or anything like that. And so it was. He. He was willing to recognize Indian talent, and both in the queen and in other kings, and appoint them as rulers, as governors of his new empire in India.
So something I want to talk about as well, because we know he doesn't sire heir, and he doesn't, far as I'm aware, he doesn't marry anyone in his lifetime and before he dies. But did he ever have lovers or male or female lovers at the time on his campaign? And did he ever have time for sexual, not for lack of better words, sexual conquest, if you will, for lack of better words? Did he ever have sexual relationships on the campaign or in his? Was it more a what we can call today asexual, like for example Charles XII of Sweden, who only worried about campaigning and never really had much sexual relationship, but was it more like a general that didn't really care about sexual relations, or did he have some fun, to put it that way, in once in a while?
It's interesting. We know that Alexander had both male and female lovers, but it does not seem to have been something that was very important to him. We learn about other generals like Julius Caesar, whoever, you know, who every chance they get, you know, they're sleeping with somebody. But Alexander wasn't like that. He did actually, when he got to Afghanistan, ancient Bactria, he did actually marry a local princess there. But it seemed to have been mostly a political sort of marriage. Either male or female does not seem to have been a particularly important part of Alexander's life. He wanted to be a conqueror, and that's what he thought about.
Well, the concern among his generals in maintaining the empires, we will discuss, of course, on his death very soon. Well, the concern that he should sire a male heir, whether it was a bastard, illegitimate child or not, was
Yes.
the concern that among them that he should focus as well on siring an heir to the empire to keep the empire intact. Just as we know, it would deteriorate really quickly after his death and create a Hellenistic world, as we will talk about. As well, the red concern that among about the hair.
There was, and there was, people were encouraging Alexander to get married, to have an heir, to have sons. And that's one reason I think he does marry this princess in Afghanistan. And they do end up actually having a son. By the time Alexander dies, the son is just an infant, so it didn't really help. But I think there was a great deal of interest in Alexander having an heir, but there all probably was also people who preferred that he not have an heir because it increased their chances of perhaps inheriting the empire. Someday. So there always was, in general, concern that he have an heir.
Something that the Macedonians are famous for, probably one of the reasons why the Greeks saw them as a semi-barbarous tribe, where that they liked drinking and alcohol was a big part of Macedonian court as well. And of course, Alexander would be no different in that ground. So one of the theories, I think, that he died so young was alcoholism. So how,
Yes.
let's talk about the drinking habits of Alexander as well, because like you said, drinking was, of course, a big part of Alexander's life as well. So would you classify him as what we would call alcoholism today? Or, of course,
Sure.
wine in those days were a little bit, not as strong as modern-day wine,
Yeah.
but it
Yeah.
was still had an effect. So let's talk about a little bit about the alcohol in
Yeah.
Alexander's life.
I mean, it was in ancient Greece, everybody drank wine, but in Macedonia, alcohol, wine was very important part, and it was not unusual for when Alexander was on campaign, you know, every night for them, he and his men to get drunk at the end of the night. And then wake up and fight the next day. It was an important part, and so I think it would be probably fair to think of Alexander as an alcoholic, along with most of the people in his army. Probably it was a very important part of Macedonian culture. So I think that ultimately did affect his health.
Let's talk about, you mentioned briefly before, but let's talk about how Alexander wanted to go further on to in India. Maybe even if he had his will, maybe he would have unified the entire India as well if he had a will about it. But it's the generals, of course. So let's talk about the return journey. Where was it? And what was the return journey like before? I want to kind of compare, I don't know if it's the right comparison, but Napoleon's march from Moscow, in a sense. Can you compare the return journey kind of similar way, where, of course, they don't have the most Russian winter, that part,
Yes.
so, but, you know, what was the return journey home like, where
Yeah.
supply lines, and, of course, with eventually Alexander's death in
Yeah.
the famous death scene?
Well, I think there are some good comparisons with Napoleon's return from Moscow. Alexander did not have to deal with the Russian winter, but he did have to march across the deserts of southern Iran, which were very difficult. And many people in his army died of thirst and of hunger. And so he had to march back across southern Iran all the way to Babylon, where his capital was. But Alexander was different from Napoleon in that he had won. He had conquered the Indus Valley, had conquered that part of India. And so he was marching back as a victor. But still, it was a very difficult return for Alexander and his men before they finally got to Babylon.
Let's talk about the famous death of Alexander and the mythology about the heir to the empire of Alexander. And I want to not well, I don't want to talk about the dissolution of the empire in just now, but I want to talk about how the famous that he doesn't really point out an error, but that he said supposedly say that the most qualified person should be the heir. So let's talk about some of the mythology surrounding Alexander's death. Was it poison, or was it simply that he drank too much, that he drank himself to exhaustion, so to speak? Or that how, what is your take on Alexander's death?
Well, it's, again, like the death of Philip, it's very hard to know exactly what happened. We have descriptions of Alexander. He's 32 years old. He's almost 33 at this point, still a young man. He had been wounded a number of times, sometimes quite seriously during the campaign. So he was always, he had that physical disability, I guess you could say. He had suffered malaria several years earlier. But he, when he gets back to Babylon, he's drinking a lot, and he comes down with a very bad fever. And this lasts for about 2 days, and then eventually gets worse and worse. And everybody around him realizes, and Alexander realizes, that he's going to die. He's not going to make it. And so, he dies. But people have said, maybe he was poisoned or whatever. It's hard to know, honestly. It could have, I think it was probably a combination of things, probably alcoholism, probably exhaustion, but probably some disease like typhoid or something like that, or malaria. It's hard to know. But anyway, Alexander's lying there on his bed in Babylon. He's surrounded by all of his generals. And he does not have an heir. His only son from an Afghanistan princess is just an infant. And so they say to Alexander, who do you want to inherit your kingdom? And the story goes that with his last breath, Alexander said, whoever is strongest should inherit my kingdom. So he doesn't name an heir. Which, of course, is going to lead to some chaos after his death, but then he dies.
Let's talk about the aftermath of Alexander and how the empire dissolution, because like you said, it will be chaos, and no one, of course, everyone would rule and be Alexander's heir. So let's talk about the aftermath and the dissolution of Alexander's short-lived empire.
Yes, after Alexander dies, then there, immediately people begin to fight about who is going to take over. And what happens is the generals end up dividing it. They maintain the fiction that it's still a unified empire, but they divide it. And so you get Ptolemy, who takes over Egypt. You have Seleucus, who takes over much of Asia. You have several different generals who divide up and carve up the Empire of Alexander. And for the years to come, they're going to fight with each other about it. Ptolemy was actually the smartest one of all, I think, because he took a relatively small kingdom of Egypt, but it was very wealthy and it was fairly easy to defend too. And so he is the one, and his heirs, Ptolemy's heirs, last for 200 or 300 years until we come to the famous Queen Cleopatra, who was the last heir of Ptolemy. But there was truly chaos and fighting and fighting over the body of Alexander after his death as well.
What happened to the body of Alexander, and how did they end up? So I do believe he would end up in Alexandria eventually, but how did they end up deciding what to do with Alexander's body, and why did they end up with him in Alexandria? And do we know if we can find the real supposed bones of Alexander today? Is it possible?
It's a great question. Alexander was supposed to be buried in Macedonia, in a royal tomb in Macedonia. They built this great cart and put his embalmed body on it and were marching back to Macedonia when Ptolemy sends him some of his men and basically hijacks the body of Alexander and brings it down to Egypt. And he builds a great mausoleum for Alexander in Alexandria, where the body is eventually laid to rest.
So we
And
go
this
to
is.
see Alexandra in the end, just from his grave.
So, but the thing is, and many people have tried to find the grave of Alexander, and it was there in Alexandria for many years. It was visited by Roman emperors several hundred years later. But at some point, probably because of an earthquake, it just collapsed and was eventually lost. And so now nobody knows exactly where it was. Every couple of years, somebody will say, "Oh, I found the tomb of Alexander," but it never actually works out. But it's possible, maybe, though, that someday somebody will find the tomb of Alexander, but it's there in Alexandria somewhere. It may be underneath the ocean now. But it's there somewhere for for somebody to find.
If we do somehow find it, can DNA research test actually define if this is the real Alexander, or do we not, like we said, we spoke about Saint Nicholas in for the Christmas special, but and we said we don't have a DNA comparison to actually confirm that Nicholas is in Bari, but is it the same with Alexander that the innate results test scans can't really do and reveal if it is the body of Alexander, or is the body case can it actually reveal if, with DNA scans?
I think they probably could, because we do have we do know the tombs of Macedonian nobility in Macedonia. And so they have found the tombs of what they think is actually the tomb of Philip and the bones of Philip there. So I think scientists could probably do a match if they could find it. And so unlike Saint Nicholas or other people, it would be impossible. But with Alexander, I think it really would be possible to do a DNA match.
So let's hope someone find the body in the bottom of the ocean on third three floors under the city of Alexandria one day. But I want to end with what you say is the legacy of Alexander, and though his empire was short-lived, the man himself lived on, even being more famous than his father. But what do you say is his legacy of him?
Well, the greatest legacy of Alexander, I think, is the spreading of Greek culture throughout North Africa and the Middle East. Greek culture had been fairly restricted before Alexander, but Alexander was a great spreader, a missionary, if you will, of Greek culture. And so Greek becomes widely spoken all the way from India to Egypt. Greek becomes the new language, and they begin to study. Everybody studies Homer, everybody studies Plato, and eventually even the Romans are all going to become fluent in Greek. And Alexander is the one who really started Hellenistic culture, and with its great scientific discoveries and all. And he also becomes the model. If you ask any general, ask Napoleon, ask Julius Caesar, who was the greatest general of all, they would have all said Alexander the Great, because he was the model for so many people. And so this is why I think after 2,300 years, we are still so fascinated with this young man who conquered much of the known world at the time.
Do you think that he's actually one of the few people who deserve the epithet, the great?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he certainly did some difficult things. He committed slaughter on a vast scale sometimes, but compared to most people in the ancient world, he was actually fairly mild. But yes, I think he does deserve the title the Great. Because of what he did, he conquered the Persian Empire, and it was an amazing feat for a young man like him.
And as well, I know I said last question, but we mentioned in the beginning that the Greeks did not view the Macedonians favorably. But after Alexander and his death, how did the view of Macedonia from the Greek perspective change with the Alexander's legacy and with his conquest as a general? And how did it change at all that the Greeks view on Macedonia?
I think so. I think the people of Athens in the south still look down on the Macedonians, but I think they became more accepting at that point. And it wasn't long after that point, actually, that the Romans took over all of Greece and Macedonia, and so it was a kind of a leveling there. But yeah, I think the views of the Macedonians probably changed after Alexander.
And of course, I think the movie on Alexander tries to fit Jenny together a little bit rehabilitation these days. Do you think what do you think about? And I'm either I don't know if you've seen the director's cut or just the original theatrical
Yeah.
cut, but what do you think of the movie Alexander?
I liked it actually. I think in many ways, if you want to find out like what it was like for a battle, they did a fantastic job there. But I liked the movie. Just in short, I think it was pretty good. And there have been several other. There was a film on Netflix recently about Alexander, and so there have been some actually fairly good. Looks at Alexander.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure to talk to you about Alexander today. Before you go, do you have anything you want to promote or share on social media? You want where people might find you if they have any more questions or books you want to share? If you've written anything about the topic we discussed today that you want to share?
Wrote a book on Alexander the Great, if you'd like it. I wrote it about 15 years ago, and it's still out there. And if anybody'd like to read it, it's in a number of different languages. Probably not Norwegian, but in others. It's there. On my website, philipfreemanbooks.com, you can see what other things I'm writing. I wrote a book about Hannibal and lots of fun things.
Again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a great pleasure. This has been With That Aged Well. We are available on social media on Instagram, on Twitter /X. With That Aged Well. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on Spotify, consider giving us 5 stars. That would help us out a lot. If you are on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a review. If you see it, I will try to read it on the podcast as well. And if you're on YouTube, please like, share, and subscribe. And I'll see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.